Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife classic episode, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. These classic episodes are full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them again for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This week I'm talking to David Ditchfield about his book Shine On. David had a near-death experience when he had an accident that involved him being pulled under a train. Since his near-death experience, David has had profound life changes. He now paints incredible pictures and has composed a symphony that was performed by an orchestra. If you want to see his paintings and hear his music, you can go to his website, shineonthestory.com. During the interview, we talk about the paintings, so if you're in a position to look at his website while listening to this podcast, that will give you a much better idea of what we're talking about. Hi, David. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast. It's great to be able to talk to you.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me along.
Now, your book was really fascinating, and it's not just a book that talks about specifically the near-death experience, but it talks about all sorts of other things in your life. And you start the book off with a visit to a medium that tells you something's sort of going to happen.
That's right, yeah.
So what happened there, and why did you choose to start the book there?
Well, basically, I mean, I figured that, I'd gone to see that medium, and that wasn't at the point of my life where spirituality had even entered my thought pattern at all. So I guess I thought that was a good place to start, because I wanted people to realize that I was the different person I was before my NDE. And that this spiritual event was quite a significant happening, because basically the story goes that is I'd been traveling up from London where I was living to go and stay with my sister and her family for the weekend. And on that train trip, I was sat opposite a lovely elderly couple, and the lady sat in front started chatting to me. And she said, oh, we're off to see a medium tonight. And she was going, she's very good. You know, nobody knows who she is. She's a hidden gem. And I was going, okay. And she was very insistent and giving me a flyer and saying, you should come along. And I was going, okay. So I remember I just folded it up and put it in my pocket. I arrived at my sister's, and there was a lot of stuff going on when I arrived. She was busy with the kids and stuff. So I said, look, I'm just going to go and have a pint down at the local pub. So I went for a drink. And while I was sat in there, I just pulled this flyer out of my pocket. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to go. So I called my sister. I said, I'll be back later. So off I went. And I arrived at this tiny little spiritualist church, which was absolutely packed when I walked in there, and found myself a seat. And lots of people had come along to get messages from their loved ones that had passed on and what have you. I didn't have any of that in my mind at all. I wasn't really concerned with getting any messages. So I just sat there and observed it all, really. And then this medium, who was brilliant, by the way, she really was coming out with a lot of great information that was connecting with these people. And then she suddenly turned round and said to me, she looks at me and she said, the man in the blue sweater, your life is about to change. And I was going, oh, okay. So I figured at that point, great, you know, what is this, the lottery winning? You know, is this the you know, everything I've been dreaming for? And I said, in what way is it going to change? And she said, she stopped and she was like, almost like talking to these people in their mind. And then she turned around and she said, they're not telling me. They're not giving anything away other than it's going to be big and be ready for it and you will be protected. And so I said, okay, so that was it. So that was a couple of months, you know, prior to the actual accident itself and the near-death experience. So, yeah, I thought that was as good a place to start as any, really.
And it's a sort of a verification in a way that there was really some kind of spiritual connection for this medium.
Yeah, absolutely. After I'd had the accident and the near-death experience, she was one of the first people that I wanted to try and track down. I wanted to trace her and talk to her because I thought, wow, when I looked back in hindsight, that message was basically telling me that my life was about to change in a very big way. And what I didn't realize, it was nothing to do with material gains that I was hoping for or the girlfriend that I was hoping for. It was more that my life was going to change spiritually. So it was a very significant event. And, you know, to me also, synchronicity plays a big part in my life now. And I realized that was leading up to the whole event of the near-death experience itself. It was like a precursor, if you like.
Yeah. So could you tell us, how did the near-death experience come about? What happened?
Well, basically, I'd come up from London. My life was going pretty, pretty bad at that point. I'd hit hard times. I was struggling, and I was drinking heavily. And basically, I was just picking up work wherever I could. And most of that work was you'd go to the local pub to hustle for sort of any labouring work, manual labouring work on building sites and stuff like that. So I was basically getting work and then drinking my wages, and then it was just like this vicious circle. So my sister said, look, you're in a bad way. You need to come and chill out with us for a while. Just, you know, get away from London. So I did. So I was up there staying with her for a few weeks. And I'd met this girl actually a few weeks before that, and we got on really well. We had a great connection, and we kept in touch by phone. And so she came up to stay for a few days. So it was at that point that she had to go back to London that I was seeing her off at the railway station. And as we stepped onto the platform, the train pulled in, and it was a cold February day. And I got this very thick quality, like 3/4 length sheepskin coat on. And I remember stepping on the train and helping her on with my bags, with her bag, sorry, and giving her a hug and a kiss goodbye. And then the emergency door buzzer alert went off. And so I stepped back to get off and was still saying goodbye to her. And as I did, this 3/4 length sheepskin coat got caught in the closing doors. The doors just slammed to automatically, as they do. And I couldn't pull it out. It was just completely jammed in there. And so I looked around on the platform, hoping to see a guard, you know, and there wasn't a guard at all anywhere in sight. And so I called out for help and just, you know, hoping somebody would turn up, but nobody did. Then the engine started to rev up, and I saw the two buttons either side of the doors open and close, you know, and they didn't work. I was banging on the glass, everything I could, really. And I remember there was just one guy who was stood behind me, and he said, you know, take your coat off, mate, take it off. But I knew that I wouldn't be able to release it because it was like a heavy-duty coat that was just really kind of like gripping my jumper that was on underneath. So there was no way. And I looked into the eyes of Anna, who was stood on the other side, and I just thought, this is it. I'm going to die. And I think she felt the same looking at her face. You know, she was terrified. And the train started edging out, and before you knew it, it was picking up rapid speed. In fact, they go really fast as they pull out of stations. But when you're on the outside, it's a different story. And I lost my footing and got dragged along the platform and then pulled in between the space between the platform's edge and the train itself. And then down I went underneath, and I was just thrown into the gates of hell. You know, it was just complete.
So you completely missed the wheels. It's almost a miracle that it's going at that fast that you slip between them.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, I don't know what I must have hit the wheels at some point, because my arm got severed from the elbow down, and then I got thrown around like a rag doll from all over the place. It was like being thrown into a spin dryer in a washing machine or whatever, a full spin. It was just complete mayhem. And I was totally sort of conscious throughout the whole thing. And so I didn't black out, and it was just craziness. And then I just suddenly did hit the ground. And then I just remember just lying in between the tracks, and the train continued to sort of travel at great speed above my head. And I just kept my face right down into the oily gravel, and eventually it passed on. And that's when I realised that this heavy duty sheepskin coat was now shredded, you know, and I noticed then that my arm was in a really bad way. It was completely cut right open as well. And yeah, so yeah, it was pretty, terrifying to say the very least. Yeah. And the emergency service guys arrived really quick, actually, because there was actually a hospital just around the corner from the station. So they were there like within minutes, and they managed to, they just started cutting through my clothes and stuff, and then got me onto a stretcher. And up onto the platform, which is I don't know how they managed that, but they did. And I arrived eventually in the hospital. I didn't go to the one that was just around the corner, because the doctor in the back of the ambulance said to me, look, you're in a pretty bad way here, and there's a hospital around the corner, but the one I think that's going to really save you is a drive. It's about, can you do it? It's going to be a good, about 15, 20 miles away. I said, yeah, let's go. So we just sped down the motorway. It was like a rocket taking off and with the sirens going. And then we eventually arrived at Adam Brooks Hospital, which I'm glad that I did go there, because it was, it really is an amazing place. And we arrived and we're into the emergency department at the A&E. And I saw like this big semicircle of, team of doctors and stuff waiting for me, really, so they kind of wheeled me in, and there were doctors frantically rushing around trying to save me. I was losing copious amounts of blood at that point, and they were just it was all very high tension, and I was in a lot of pain, and I just remember it just being very bright and very loud. And my family eventually arrived. And they got there. I don't know how they managed to get in the time they did, but they were there. And they came in and saw me and were chatting and stuff. And then my friend Anna, who I've been seeing off the train, was also there. So I was very concerned for her well-being, because we'd just been through something so incredibly dramatic. And, she just looked like she was sat there in complete shock. So I asked for her to come over. So my family got her, and she came over, and we just talked. And she was just shaking her head in disbelief. She said, I can't believe you're alive, And so she said, I got off the train at the station, the next station, and it was announced over the system there that there'd been a fatality at the last station, so all the trains would be delayed. So she'd had confirmation. I was actually dead at that point. So, yeah, it must have been absolutely terrifying for her. And, so it was at that point, anyhow, where I was lying in the emergency department, and the consultant, who was brilliant, came over to me and he said, look, we're going to be taking you straight into surgery now. And I said, that's okay. So, and it was just before that point of going into surgery that I left my body. And I went from all the, the high tense sort of atmosphere and the noise of the doctors and the pain and the agony to this beautiful, warm sort of dark place. And it was just, it felt like a darkened room to me at first.
So just a couple of questions there. Did you actually die? And so it's a near death experience, or did this happen and your body was fine, so to speak? I mean, considering.
Yeah, I didn't die clinically, no. And that's, although it's called a near-death experience, that it doesn't, from what I've done quite a lot of interviews with other people now and looked into it since, and it's not, you don't have, some people do die clinically, on the table or what have you, but not, it's not always the case. It's basically at a state of near death, which it was for me. As I say, I'd just been through that under a train, and I was losing a lot of blood. So it was just So it happened while I was still clinically alive, but it was. So I was in the emergency department at that point. Yeah.
And you didn't have that thing of floating over your body and looking down or anything. It's like you click your fingers and you're in another place.
Yeah. I wasn't looking down on my body. I was in another place altogether. I was, as I say, it felt like a darkened room at first, and uh, and And I suddenly realized that I'd looked around, I could see these pulsating colors, like they were like orbs that were just slowly pulsating and flashing all around me, like yellows and greens and oranges. And so that felt very calming to me. And I looked to see what I was lying on. I realized I wasn't actually lying on the hospital trolley anymore, but I was actually lying on what was like a big, huge piece of slate rock. And as I lay on this rock, I just kind of like remember just looking at the sheer size of it. It was like a sort of a best way to describe it, it's almost like a medieval altar, you know. And I looked down at my body to check to see how that was looking, and everything was fixed. There was no cuts or bruises or severed arms. Everything was back intact, and I was just covered in this blue sort of satin sort of silk sheet, if you like, that was covering my body. And it felt very calming to have this cover over me. And then I felt the presence of somebody or something near me, and I looked up, and just at the right of my feet, I saw this beautiful being, like an androgynous being, neither male or female, and just with this kind of white blonde hair and this kind of skin that was just kind of luminous and radiating light and from within. And it was like this kind of knowing expression on the face of this being. And I felt like I'd known this being for a long time. You know, it was just watching over me caringly and almost like guarding me. And I just felt an awful lot of love coming from the being. And I laid my head back. And as I did, I remember also above me were three grids of white light that were shining down into my eyes. And I couldn't take my gaze away from those grids. So there were really powerful light that was coming from them, and it was like a healing energy. It was so powerful that normally you wouldn't be able to look in with the human eye, you know, if it was electric or sunlight, you just couldn't do it. But with this light, you could, and I just couldn't take my gaze away. And I just laid there, and then I suddenly felt that there was the presence of two other beings with me either side, you know. There was a female form, and like one was like white Caucasian with brown hair, just wearing a simple brown dress, and then the other one was more sort of Asian Indian, American Indian in appearance, and they just had their hands slowly hovering over my body and healing me, and you know, just kind of helping me. It's not so much healing my body, but it felt like they were healing my soul. And this experience was just really powerful, and the energy that was coming through from their hands was just extraordinary. It was almost like an expression of it felt like love that was just coming from those hands, and that love was just kind of like going through right throughout me. It was almost like every molecule on my body was vibrating from this feeling of love. And I knew I was being healed, and I knew that it was my soul that was being healed. And I felt like it was, you know, like it was being bathed or prepared for something. It was just a wonderful thing.
Did you have any communication with them?
Not verbally. We didn't actually talk. It was a lot of telepathy, really, that was going on there. You know, the communication, and I was. It's really hard to explain that it's a completely different dimension, and it's as real as, say, that I am sat here now sort of looking at my microphone and talking to you. It's just it's as three-dimensional and as that, but it's a different thing, that it's like there was no need for conversation. You know, I could feel that they were communicating to me what was going on and who they were, and I knew ultimately that the first person that I saw was like the soulmate, if you like, my higher consciousness, if you like. It was a part of me, that being. And because as I say, it felt like I'd known this person for longer than my whole lifespan and beyond. And there was a connection there, and it was very, very powerful. So, yeah, at that point, I started to. I also realized, because up until that point, I carried a lot of guilt in my life. You know, everyone used to joke that guilt was my middle name. You know, it was just, and all that had dispersed. All those feelings of insecurities and shame and guilt had all gone, and this love that was coming through was teaching me that I was loved and that I was okay, and that I was a good person, as I felt at that point. And as I thought about my family, I thought, well, they're going to be, because I clearly thought at this stage that I died, that this was it, that I'd gone over to the next level, and that was it, I'd died from the accident. So I figured my family were just going to be, they were already really distraught about what had happened down in the hospital. My mother was in tears, you know, and in the A&E department. So I looked over the edge to see whether I could see my family over the edge of this big rock. And I couldn't see them at all. But what I did see was this beautiful waterfall of stars that were like cascading down into other galaxies and down into infinity. And it was just like it was an enormous sight, you know, and very powerful and very beautiful. And, you know, these stars were just constantly just falling over an edge, and then shooting stars were just dropping through in the middle. And I was just going, wow, yeah, this is like amazing. This is just really beautiful. And then, of course, I realized at that stage that I wasn't actually in a darkened room, in a small darkened space, that I was actually in the universe itself, and that I was a part of it. And so that was a very powerful moment. And so I lifted my head back over, and interestingly enough, rather than feeling that guilt and shame that I couldn't see my family, I just remember saying to myself, oh, that's okay, you know, they'll be fine. I'll be seeing them soon anyhow. You know, they'll be coming up to this wonderful place themselves. You know, it was lovely. I just thought that's okay and went with it. And then as I turned over, something really amazing happened then. It was the energy that I could feel that was coming off the three beings, which was already powerful enough, suddenly had turned up tenfold, and I could feel this amazing power. And I looked, and there was this huge white tunnel of white light that was kind of closing in on me. And this tunnel of white light was like surrounded by all these beautiful flames that were just slowly circling round. And it was a really powerful moment. And this energy, the closer it got, the more I could sense this energy that was just, again, was just vibrating through my body. And I instantly knew, what again through telepathy, that this was actually the source of all creation that I was looking at. This was God, you know. This is you know, the great maker, and not the, you know, the image that we're all used to seeing, the image of Michelangelo's Vatican ceiling God. You know, this is a big, huge tunnel of white light surrounded in all these remarkable flames. And so I remember I just put my head back, and I remember I was just smiling with joy at that point. And just as I did that, I suddenly came crashing back down to earth, and I was back in my body, back into the hospital with all the people rushing around and the lights, and then my body, you know, in pain. And then the consultant coming up to me and saying, right, we're going to take you into surgery now and stuff. And I went, okay. But I was just, part of me was just like feeling, wow, what's just happened there? Why have they sent me back? How come I'm back here? You know, but the main part of me was just so filled with excitement and joy at what had just happened that I remember I just grabbed Anna's hand, and I said, Anna, I've got something really important to tell you. And she said, not now, not now. I said, no, this is, you've got to hear this, you know. And she said, you can tell me later, you know. And so anyway, so that was it, and then off I went for 8 hours of of the first lot of surgery. Yeah.
And so how long did it feel it took, the whole near-death experience?
Yeah, again, it's interesting because it would have taken a matter of moments, minutes would have passed. I'm not sure how long, but minutes would have passed, but while it happened for me in real time. But as far as I was concerned, again, it's a different dimension, so there's no sense of time, and you don't think about time, and so it was. I couldn't gauge it exactly to you, but it felt like an eternity. Me that was there, you know, it feel like a matter of minutes, basically. So yeah, it felt like it went on a lot longer than that.
And in the book you describe that place as the true reality, and that perhaps where we are on Earth isn't the true reality. Is that how it feels to you? Does it feel like the Earth is just some pale imitation?
No, not at all. It doesn't feel like it's a pale imitation. One of the things that coming back from a near-death experience, and it's not just me, other people have had the same thing, you appreciate the Earth for all its beauty. You know, I mean, I'm unlike I did before. You know, I appreciate everything from a beautiful starlit sky to the smallest insects. You know, Earth really is. It is like heaven on earth. So yeah, it's just that I guess what I was trying to say in the book is that, going back to what I was talking about earlier, that it's from an emotional point of view, all the layers that we all carry around with us, that society or what have you, or upbringing or whatever, has put on us, all those layers don't exist anymore. It's just your pure soul that's existing in this other sphere, as it were, and that pure soul is just the organic, authentic you, and that's what I was trying to explain, really. So that was the reality of it all. There wasn't the me that had become the guilty, sort of feeling like I was a loser and a failure and all those different things that I was carrying around with me on Earth. So that's basically what I'm trying to put across.
Did you feel that the women that were there with you and the androgynous person, they could kind of access any part of you? So you couldn't hide anything. They knew everything about you.
Oh, totally. That's exactly how it felt. It's like, you know, they knew me inside out. It's almost like they knew exactly what I'd been through in my previous life before that point. And I felt the love coming from them, and I felt a sense of, it's okay, it's all right, it's okay to be you, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, you're not that person that you think you are, and I knew that straight away. Especially, as I say, with the androgynous being, you know, the androgynous being was basically my ultimate, you know, keeper, my guide, you know, and I'm sure has been through me throughout my whole life anyhow, and watched over me and seen everything that I've gone through. And the other two as well. Yeah, because I firmly believe that we all have spirit guides like that are with us all. You know, we don't have to go through a dramatic accident and a near-death experience to realize that we've got them. You know, it wasn't just that I had them, because that had happened. They've been with me right up until that point throughout my whole life. And so we've all got them. And it's just that I was, you know, in a place that I was lucky enough to actually encounter them and be with them and be healed by them.
Do you get any sense that are there around you now?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. It's something that I, because of that moment, that I'm really familiar with them. I sense them around me constantly, and I call upon them when I need to, but not all the time, but I don't feel afraid to call upon them either. It's that's what they want you to do, is what I sense. But that they've been with me through, to help me with my journey since, you know, and to help me live my life in a completely different way and to be creative, and they helped me sort of create and bring things alive that I would never have dreamt possible before.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, and I hope you check it out. And for you, this really was a spiritually transformative experience. It changed you completely, didn't it? And I think there's one of the criticisms of near-death experiences. The skeptics might say, well, if you were on drugs or you'd had a nasty knock on the head from the train or something, it was just an hallucination. But lots of people do get that. Their lives don't change. The person doesn't change like you
absolutely
have.
Absolutely. That's really correct what you're saying. I agree with you on that big time. Yeah, it's true. And, and other people I've met since who've had near-death experiences, their lives have changed in exactly the same way, you know. And interestingly enough, a lot of them had pretty a rough journey on the way up beforehand, you know, the run-up, I should say, to it. But the other thing is as well is that the big difference between hallucinations and dream state is that hallucinations and dreams are, you know, they're quite chaotic and bizarre and are usually not logical. Whereas the NDE, as I said to you earlier, it was ultra real and logical. I've remembered every part of it. I remember when I first woke up the next day or the next night, I should say, in hospital, I was really worried that I was going to forget everything. But I've never forgotten any of it at all. It stayed with me very clearly. But that's the difference as well. I mean, if you think that, you know, that this happened in 2006, I don't think I'd still be talking to you now about it. And I wouldn't have, and also I would have forgotten about it, or it would all have changed in my mind after all that time. If it was a dream, if I had a really powerful dream and I was telling you about it now, it would have changed in dimension from its original form, if you like. So, yeah. It's something that, yeah, I mean, it's great the scientists are looking into it. I know that. I mean, in fact, I was contacted by our local BBC radio because some scientists were traveling around the UK going to various hospitals, and they were going to Adam Brooks Hospital, where I'd been, to do some studies there on whether people had near-death experiences or not. And so they asked me if I'd go on the show and talk from my point of view, because they knew about me and stuff. So I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I was really happy to go on and talk about things from my perspective. You know, my take on it all is that in terms of science, it's like, yes, that we totally need science. I mean, if without science, I wouldn't be sat here talking to you now, because they wouldn't have been able to save me, basically, you know. So I needed science to save my physical body and what have you. But it's something it's been taken very seriously now, which is great to see, because I think more and more people are coming forward and saying that they've had near death experiences. And
because you reminded me of your time in the ward on the hospital. There was a young man there who'd been in a motorbike accident, and he told thought he had the same sort of experience as you, but he said he'd never talk about it.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, basically he'd been chased by the police. I think he'd stolen a motorbike or whatever, you know, and he was going 125 miles an hour, he told me, and then came off and survived it. You know, which again, this is pretty miraculous, you know. And but he'd come from a background that basically I could tell that his mates basically I said, have you told anyone about this? And what happened was, I was in the physio gym when I was in hospital, and they're all amputees in there, and so And I told them my story when we stopped for a coffee one day, because we all used to chat and have a coffee. And everyone was totally captivated by it. And that he pulled me to one side afterwards. He said, "That happened to me, mate," something like that. I said, "All right." I said, "Have you told anyone?" He said, "No." He said, "All my mates would think I was crackers, you know, think I was nuts." And I said, "It doesn't matter, you know." But I don't know. I haven't seen him since. Who knows? He may have gone away and thought, "I can't hold this anymore," you know, and he may have spoken about it. I hope so. I, you know, but there are going to be other people, yes, I'm sure, that kind of think, well, they don't want to make it a part of their lives and they don't want to share it. But for me, it was right from the off, I felt that I'd got to share it with everybody in some form, you know. I felt that I'd got this mission. I thought, why, when I was in the hospital, I thought, why have they sent me back? There's a reason they sent me back. And I was desperately trying to find an answer to that, you know. So yeah, for me, it's been a no-brainer that it's never really left me. Yeah.
And so it was in hospital that you asked somebody to bring you some pencils and a sketch pad.
That's right, yeah.
Had you been artistic before the accident?
No, I hadn't. No, it was literally what it was my sister come in to see me the very next night, and I was they'd given me my own room in the hospital, which is great. So I was in this very peaceful little room, and she was chatting at the end, and she said, "Is there anything I can get you?" As you know, my sister, as a relative would say, and I said, "Yeah, can you get me a small A5 sketch pad and a pencil?" And because, like I said, I was desperate to try and sketch what I'd seen in case I forgot, because I just as I lay there, as I come around from my operation, I thought it through and I thought, I've got to paint this. I've got to show people what I'd seen. I've got to do a big painting. I just got to. It didn't matter. I didn't care. I didn't care that I'd never done anything like that before in my life. I thought, I'm just going to do it, and I've got to paint. It's got to be like a big Renaissance style painting, you know, that you see in the Vatican, and just to show exactly what, because it was such a powerful place I'd been to. There's no other way I could do it other than on a big canvas. So I'd already got it in my mind right from the off. That's what I wanted to do. So anyway, so she did. And the nurses very kindly propped me up in my bed because I couldn't move, to be honest with you, at that point. And I remember doing this very faint little sketch of what I'd seen. And I thought, right, I've got it now. I've got that, just in case I forget. And funnily enough, that little sketch, I've still got it. And you can barely see it. Only I can see it. But it's exactly... It's the very first painting that I did, and from that point on, it's just I just continue to paint. I just, you know, I was just, it all came through. But we're not talking about my guides being there for me. They were helping me to sort of put this painting together, you know, because I was very apprehensive at first, you know, and at the idea. Of course, I wanted to do it with a passion, but I thought, I remember looking at this big canvas that was like stood against the wall in my sister's house, and I thought, can I pull this off, you know? What happened was, some friends of hers, they run like a local Pilates yoga center, and they come around to visit, or we bumped into them in town actually, and then we were chatting, and her friend Jane said, "How's that painting of yours coming on yet? Have you started it?" Because he knew I was going to do it, you know. And I said, "No, there's not enough light or room in here. I can't do it, you know, putting it off." And she said, "Well, look, we've got a studio up in the attic, our place, and it's free for a week. Why don't you come? You can get started then." You know, she's that kind of proactive person. So I said, "Okay." So off I went, and I started painting it, and I ended up staying there for 2 years. It was great. They were really lovely. They just enjoyed having me there, and they didn't charge me any rent. And they just said, we're enjoying watching what's coming together here. And people were coming up and looking at these paintings that I was doing because they were fascinated, you know, by the fact that a lot of people seemed to know about what had happened to me anyhow, because it had been on the local news, you know, the guy had been under the train and stuff. So, of course, people knew about it, and so they were fascinated to see what I was painting, and I talk about it, and the more I talked about it, the more animated I became, and the more animated the painting became. And I used to step back at the end of each day, and I go, wow, that's I can't believe I'm painting this. You know, it's like, and I knew straight away that I was getting help from the other side, because it's interesting. Right at the very beginning of as you know, of being back from the NG for the, it was a very intense period of feeling like I was still attached to that other place I'd been to. Like, you know, there's a cord that was still the energy was still coming through from it, and so I just knew that energy was coming from there. And I used to just sit back and, you know, thank them. Before that in my life, I'd never prayed, you see. So I used to sit in a chair and look up and go, thank you so much, you know, because it was just such a joy to see this all coming into fruition, as you say, or whatever, you know. It was coming together as a painting, and it was looking just how I wanted it to look. So, yeah.
So in the painting, you've got the two women and your guide, and there's the tunnel of light and these three sort of rectangular lights above you.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
There's somebody on the left and there's somebody on the right, and then there's a kind of like an old man as well.
That's right, yeah.
So who are they?
Okay, well, I mean, the other ones that at that point, I was just, you know, I was just trying to get everything into that one painting, because I thought it was the only one I was going to do. And I wanted to try and not only just do like a sort of like, if you like, a visual summary of what I'd seen, I wanted to try and paint the energy that I felt. I felt that there was more than just those three people there and the tunnel of light. I felt that there was, you know, there were other angels around that were just circulating all this beautiful energy. So I put them in just to try and show the sheer force of energy that was going on. So I just felt drawn to putting them in. And the old man is actually, that's my grandfather. And it was very interesting, because I was painting on that painting, and there was, for some reason, I was colouring in the background, you know, it was just quite dark. And that part of the canvas, I just hadn't got there with the brush. It was like this little white patch. And I kept thinking, I've got to get that sorted. You know, it just, you know, put something there. And nothing went there. And then what had happened was I'd started going to the spiritualist church that I talked of earlier, because that was my quest to try and find the medium. And I'd forgotten exactly where it was, to be honest with you. But, you know, my sister used to come with me and walk with me through town together. And we'd walk to the river and feed the ducks. And it was just one Sunday that we were walking back from that point that we walked through this like a passageway. And I said, there it is. That's the doorway. That's the spiritualist church. And so there was a service happening and people were going in. So I went in there. And when I went into that service, you know, they were very kind and to me, and they were very lovely and sat me down. And I sat through the service. And right at the very end, they'd have like a guest medium. We'd just stand up for half an hour and yeah, do pretty much the same kind of thing, a platform, as we call it, you know, and then give people messages. And then that, it was a different medium, but she turned around to me and said, picked me out. She said, the gentleman at the back there, I'm picking up your grandfather here, you know, and she started chatting about him, and she got him bang on. I thought, yeah, that's a brilliant description. That is him. And she said, oh, well, he's with you at the moment. And I said, oh, that's great, you know. And so I sat down, and we were having a coffee at the end. And then another elderly lady was sat next to me, was chatting, and she said, I'm the mother of that medium who stood up tonight. I said, yeah. And she said, I'm a retired medium. And she said, I said, okay. And she said, I know about your accident. And I said, oh, right, okay. And she said, the day of your accident, you were saved by not only your grandfather who was there, but also a power animal. A power animal prevented you from, you know, was saving you from in imminent death, you know, sort of thing. I said, oh, wow, that's really incredible. So straight away, I went back to the studio again the next day, and that small space on the canvas, I thought, it's got to be my grandfather, because I thought he's with me, and I felt him that was for the first time I'd been told by a medium that, you know, one of my loved ones who passed on was there for me. So that's why I painted him.
I wanted to ask about a couple of other paintings just quickly. There's one where it looks like an angel, this woman with the wings. I'm wondering where that image came from. And also there's a painting with a guy that looks like Jesus.
That's right, yeah. Firstly, the first one you talked about is actually I wanted to do a series of paintings that was kind of almost like challenging. How would you put it? People who have been judged. It's actually Kate Moss that I painted there, and she was being, amongst other people, was being getting a hard time by all the press and stuff for not having her act together and doing too much cocaine or drinking too heavily, and the paparazzi photographed her stumbling out of a nightclub, and I just wanted to sort of think to myself, well, that's just totally wrong, you know, that they're attacking her in that way, and I felt judged in my previous life before that, and it just brought me down, and a lot of that judgment was because I was drinking heavily, and so I guess in a way it was my way of sort of like processing that into a painting, and I wanted to show her as an angel. And it was taken from a series of photographs of her that were trying to show her in a point of shame, leaving a nightclub looking really disheveled, as they said in the headlines. But I wanted to, you know, paint her as an angel. So that was from a series of paintings that I started doing a bit later on. Now, the image of Christ, that came about because when I was in the church that night having that cup of coffee, a German lady came and sat down and chatted with me, and she said, you look like you could do with some healing. And she said, I don't normally say this, but we do spiritual healing here on Thursdays. Would you like to come along? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And so I did. And I started going for spiritual healing. And throughout those healing sessions, I was getting an awful lot of healing, which was helping me to, you know, I was still recovering from the accident, and I was still going into outpatients 3 times a week, and it was helping me recover very, very fast. And in those sessions, some of the spiritual healers would give clairvoyant messages, and some of them were like brilliant. You know, it's very short ones. They weren't like the same kind of thing as I was talking about earlier, the platforms in the church. They're literally what they messages that they were kind of transmitting through telepathically, if you like, from their guides as they were healing me, or my guides even, you know. And so they would say things like, you know, just very simple things like this. They started saying things like, I remember the German lady turned around to me 1 week, and I think it was another one, and said, oh, why am I seeing a violin laid across your chest? And I was going, I have no idea, you know. And then another one would say, why am I even hearing Beethoven and Wagner and, you know, all these different classical composers? I said, I've no idea, you know. And then one of them turned around and said, they're telling me that you're going to write some music about your experience. And I went, oh, okay. Because by then they all knew about me and my near-death experience, and they completely got it. You know, there was just like, you know, for them it was like, yeah, a near-death experience. We know all about this. And so I just thought, okay. So I remember I went home, and I used to play guitar, and I used to play, like, you know, nothing special, just kind of like, you know, 3-chord wonder sort of songs, you know, that I could bash out. And I figured, right, well, I couldn't play guitar anymore because of the injury to my left arm. But I got this old cheap synthesizer that I managed to get my hands on through my sister, and I got that out and sat down and started bashing out some chords on that, thinking I've got to write this song. You know, I've been told I'm going to write it, so let's do it. And I thought it was going to be a song that was going to be, you know, 3-minute pop song or whatever, like a folk song, if you like. And it just wasn't coming that way. Nothing was happening. Nothing was coming, unlike the paintings. I thought, okay, it's not happening. And then suddenly, for no an apparent reason, I just sort of sat down. I think that there was a movie on the TV, and in the background, I was half watching that. And then I started playing around with my right hand, and this chord sequence came through, and I thought, that sounds, I like the sound of that, you know. And, sorry, I'm going completely around the, I'm taking you around the houses here, but
all right.
So back to the image of Christ was through one of those spiritual healing sessions, at that point when they were talking about me writing the music, and the one of the healers turned around and said, I was having a healing session, and I suddenly saw this image of Christ as I was being healed. And it was a very powerful image of him. And he was just like floating above me and just wearing like this white, beautiful white, and looking really healthy. And so I thought, that's really beautiful. And then I came through from that through to the end of that session. And as I sat up, the healer turned around to me and said, "Oh, that was very special." She said, "I saw Christ stood with you there." And I went, "Really?" And I said, "Wow, that's amazing." And so she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, so did I saw him as well." So, of course, that's what inspired me to go away and paint Christ. And that's what that came from. So that image is exactly what I saw, was him floating above me, looking very healthy and very unlike the usual images you see of Christ, which is him hanging from a cross. So I wanted to paint him in that beautiful light.
And I'm glad you got talking about the music there, because I was going to ask you how that all started, because it became an orchestral piece, didn't it, rather than a guitar band sort of thing.
Exactly, that's it. Yeah, yes. It was interesting because as I started telling you, I got carried away because I got my train of thought was just taking me there. But yes, it. As I say, I figured that that's all I knew was writing songs and 3-minute songs, but it wasn't. It was so this chord progression came through, and I thought that sounds really lovely. I like that, you know. So I recorded. All I got then was a cassette player, and I just recorded it onto like a little dictaphone thing, and I did that, and I put it onto that, and then I went away, made some coffee, and came back, played it back, and it still sounded beautiful to me. So I just kept developing it up and getting it better and better, and working on it, and I started to hear sounds in my head, like different sort of horn sounds or flute sounds, and I just start to sort of intertwine those. At this point, I'd come across another friend of my sister's who was a homeopath. She was doing homeopathic sort of remedies, and she asked if she could work on me, and I said, "Yeah, that'd be brilliant." So we got chatting, and she was also a cellist in the local orchestra, so we became good friends because I'd go along and see her quite regularly to have all these different remedies given to me. And she also used to come to the yoga center, so she used to come up and look at my paintings and stuff. And then one day she said, "Oh, can we use one of your paintings for the next concert poster?" I said, "Yeah, of course." So she did do it. They did do. We used to chat. She said, "How's it going? What are you up to?" And I said, "Oh, I've just been working on this piece of music." And I said, "It sounds more like it could be played by an orchestra rather than a song that should be for a pop melody." And she said, "Oh, well, maybe we could do it one day," and then laughed, you know. And I thought, right, I'm going to hold you to that. So that encouraged me to go that one step further and bring it together. And I spoke to my brother, and he said to me, "Look, I've got this app which you can have, and you can attach it to your laptop. And then when you play onto your synthesizer, it will then sort of translate what you're playing into digital format. And then it will also, if you want, that it can register it as score, music score." I said, "That'd be brilliant." So that's what I did. And then I just got it together. And then spoke to my friend again. I said, "Look, remember that conversation we had?" He said, "Yeah." And I reminded him. I said, "Well, look, I've actually got some score together for what I think could be like the first movement of a piece of music. Would you look at it?" She said, "Yeah." So she met me with another head of the orchestra, and we met for coffee. And I remember sitting there with the score and showed it. And then they said, "Yeah, okay, we'll do it." So they agreed to perform it. So that was just, so that was great. So again, I was just, without even thinking about it, I was just doing it. I was just suddenly writing a symphony for an orchestra. And I was stepping into a completely different arena that was way out of my comfort zone because, you know, I come from a working class background and the only musical background knowledge I got was playing in punk rock and roll bands, you know. And all of a sudden there I was at the first rehearsal walking into this, seeing this whole orchestra sat there and realizing that they're all very highly educated, middle class, you know, musicians. And it was very, part of me was, was apprehensive and terrified, but part of me was felt, okay, let's do this, you know. And I walked in and I remember the conductor turned around and said, "Ah, the composer's here." I was thinking, "What composer?" You know. And then, And then he said, "David, would you like to say a few words about your piece before we start?" And I said, No, that's fine. You know, you go ahead, you know. But he said, no, come and talk. So I did do. And once I started talking about it, I realized that, again, it's like what I call channeling. I was like, I've been channeling through ideas and inspiration for the paintings and the music. I felt that I was being channeled to sort of feel relaxed enough to talk to this orchestra about the piece because the actual piece itself was about my near-death experience. And everyone was very captivated and asking questions and stuff. And it was great. And yeah.
Do you feel that the music was somehow channeled through to you? The melodies and things came from your guides that they helped you with it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This was most certainly happening in this case. There's no way I could have pulled it off. I wanted to have somebody sing it, and I knew that there was this guy who ran a choral society in Cambridge, who's one of the best tenors in Cambridge, and I'd met him, so I thought I'm gonna phone him, see if he knows anyone who could sing it. So I went over to his house and I showed him the score that I got for the part, and he looked at it. And he said, went very quiet, sort of finger over his bottom lip, and then he said, "I love the way you've got a C major sharp over an E flat major or whatever." But I was thinking, what? I was going, oh, right. And then he kind of played on the piano the two notes together. He said, "You wouldn't normally have that, but it works." You know, I said, "Oh, great." He said, "This is brilliant." He said, "I'll sing it." So he offered to sing it. So it was like, wow, you know. So I knew that I would not have been able to pull that off because I said to him, he said, "This is amazing. You've written this." And I said, "Oh, thanks." I said, "Well, I'm sure you've written plenty yourself." And he said, "No." He said, I just wouldn't have the guts to sit down and try and write a symphony for an orchestra." I was going, "Really?" He said, "No." He said, it takes an awful lot. It really does, you know. So he said, "This is really incredibly commendable that you pulled this off." So I knew that I had done something that was quite extraordinary, that I would not have been able to have done without the help of my guides. And so they helped me pull this all together in the same way as they were helping me to put the right colors onto that canvas and to guide me to actually paint the strokes and pull it all off. They definitely helped. They still do. I mean, everything I do now, every creative thing that I'm doing, they're still with me and they're still helping me to develop and put new ideas in and put stuff onto a canvas and write music as well. So, yeah.
So it really shows how much of a transformative experience it was to go from where you were to where you are now. Do you feel the near-death experience was perhaps planned before you were born, so to speak, or perhaps your guides were looking down on you in your life and seeing where you are and they thought, "You know what, we need to have a word with him," and they took the opportunity to give you a kick up the ass.
Yeah, exactly. I don't actually feel ultimately that it was predestined that before I was born that I was gonna, you know, spend the first two thirds of my life, you know, whatever, you know, going through hard times, and then suddenly they thought, right, then we'll chuck him under a train and and bring him up here. You know, I don't think it worked quite like that. I felt that, you know, I'd been, say when I was brought into this earth and I was born, then yes, I was put on a clear pathway and that was my soul, a journey. But I think I just kind of veered off it too many times, you know. It was like going down a highway and constantly looking for shortcut routes off, if you like, you know, and I was taking all those shortcut routes, but all of them were leading me into even more sort of disaster. And so, yeah, so I guess it just got to the point where I'd hit such an awful point in my life. Everything was just disastrously going wrong. And that they probably did decide it's time to sort of, I needed something really huge like that to happen, because the big thing is I had no self-love whatsoever. I'd left school without any qualifications. And when I was at school, I was undiagnosed as being dyslexic. So I used to get terrible school reports. You know, I'm not feeling sorry for myself here. This is just a fact, you know, that I got awful school reports all the time saying that I was lazy, I was inattentive, you know, all these awful things, which certainly wasn't true of me. I was actually quite wanted to learn. I wanted to get by. I wanted to fit in, you know. And so it was very destroying for me. And that I carried that with me. And so when things were going even more wrong for me, I mean, I just beat myself up constantly. And it was just carried an awful lot of shame. And I had no self-love whatsoever. And as I talked to you about earlier, that's the biggest lesson that I brought back from the other side of it all, which was love, unconditional love, you know. And I've kept that with me. Now that's like the key, you know, for me. It's like having that self-love has helped me to sort of give myself a break and view life in a much more three-dimensional sort of way, as it were.
So your book is called Shine On. And is it is it going to be published? Is it June 26th?
That's right. Yeah, it's coming out in June 26th. Yeah,
people can pre-order it from Amazon.
Yeah, it's already available now. Pre-order now, so it's been doing quite well actually in terms of pre-order. So people are obviously looking forward to it coming out. So that's great. And so yes, if anybody's interested, please do go and it's there. To pre-order, so I'm excited about that. Yeah,
and if people want to see the paintings, they want to hear the music, they're on the website, aren't they? Could you give us the web address?
Yeah, the website it's called shineonthestory.com, and if you go to the website, it's basically everything's on there. You can see the paintings, you can hear the music also via the SoundCloud page, so you can hear the symphony that I talked about, and it's all free to listen to stream, so I'm not charging for any of those things. And then there's other links on there, you know, to all the different interviews that I've been doing, because there's been quite a lot, which is great. I mean, because this book's coming out, this is like the next level of me being able to get my story out there. You know, first of all, it's through my paintings, then the music, and now with this book coming out, I'm able to do interviews and support it and talk to people like yourself, and just to be able to, you know, put that story out, which is great. And so it's good energy. And again, I feel that my guides are helping me bring this forward and hopefully bring that book out into the world with success, you know, with some, well, and I say success to me, it would just be one person buying it, that's fine. But I mean, it's just ultimately just being able to talk about it and just and have feedback from other people as well is great, you know.
Yeah, I really liked it. I liked the journey you take us on in the book, and also because it carries on past the NDE and it really goes in to show us how much it changed you and how this new artistic talent came to the fore. I suppose your family, they knew you before and after. They must be quite surprised by the change in you, are they?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they are constantly, you know, because each thing that happens, you know, they just kind of go, wow, you know, it's just astonishing, you know, so which is lovely, you know. And I lost my mother last year, sadly, but she was around for most of it, and she was, I'll never forget her at the concert, because when it was premiered, it had sold out 2 weeks in advance because there was a lot of excitement about it because I started doing local press about it. And then suddenly, again, this energy that I felt was coming through from the other side was pushing that out into the world. And then the BBC said, we want to come along and film, interview you and film the rehearsal before. And I said, that's great. So we were sat on the front row seats of this concert. And it was great because it was brilliant just to be sat there and not to be stood on stage holding a guitar and in front of two men and a dog and hoping for the best, you know. And it was like I was sat there with my family and I wasn't having to perform and I could hear my own piece being played. And it just sounded really beautiful. And when it got to the end, my mum just turned around and I'll never forget her face, her dear face. She was just crying with joy. She said that was just so beautiful and it was just like lovely. And it's not like I was looking for any kind of like what's the word, sort of like respect from my parents. They respected me a bit when I was growing up and stuff, so it wasn't like, there you go, I told you so, I am good at something. It was nothing like that, but it was just like, it was just for them, it was just lovely just to see me suddenly, you know, flowering or you know, and seeing all these different things coming out of me, and one thing after another seemed to be just even more sort of a beautiful part of the journey for them to share. So it's great, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast. It's been really fascinating.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad. I'm glad you felt that way. Yeah, it's been great chatting with you as well.
And that was an interview with David Ditchfield about his near-death experience and his book, Shine On. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon. For $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you can get an extended episode every month. These exclusive Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.